through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Welcome into Tom, Jake, and Stacy, a Wednesday edition. We're going to be talking to the professor, John Clayton, coming up at 2, live from Indianapolis, where the Combine is taking place. Now, he spoke to both John Schneider and Pete Carroll one-on-one today, so we're going to get the highlights of that later on. By the way, this hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacy brought to you by Car Toys. Now, yesterday, at the end of the show, towards the end of the show, we had kind of an unexpected conversation about the defensive line, the pass rush, and in particular, LJ Collier and what the expectation is for him, because he was basically invisible last year. Now, when I went home, guys, an odd thing happened. I tweeted out, because I was thinking about our conversation, I said, many of you think LJ Collier is a bust, but if they can coach him into a player that's good enough to draw a little attention away from Clowney, I'd call that a win. And it's certainly not too much to ask from a first-round pick. And then I got all kinds of responses, people arguing with one another. But then I happened to notice that LJ Collier himself liked that tweet. Okay.
Interesting.
Okay. I was kind of wondering why he liked it, given that it wasn't really the most flattering tweet in the world. It wasn't particularly negative either. Like, he's still my guy. I'm backing him up. He's still
Are you? Dude,
yeah.
Okay.
But then he tweets out, he says, and I can't really understand the beginning, but he says, I've been an underdog my whole life. People have written me off time after time, and I came out on top. Watch me work.
So it's interesting, you know, when you have this interaction and you have LJ Collier actually go out and like your tweets. He doesn't follow you, Tom Wassel. So
no,
obviously
still
he
does, still doesn't
so
follow.
So he is looking up your name and looking up his name, I mean, and right. You know, seeing, you know, what people are saying about him and all of that. And look, in terms of who he is and his background, yeah, he came from a tiny town. He has had to overcome a lot. He was not a shining star in the recruiting process in high school, and neither was he that guy when it came to his time at TCU. He really blossomed later on in his career. So I understand what he's saying. Now, the difference here with LJ Collier is, great, if you want to put that energy there and you're looking for motivation and all of that, I've got no problem with it. But you got to back it up. Like, you've got to back it up, and you've got to be putting in all the work that you're saying you're going to be putting in. You need to be showing us a very different side of you in year two than you did in your rookie season. And that's the hard part for us as fans, us as members of the media, is to look at LJ Collier and not be scared of what this potential pick could end up being. Because I understand that it was a unique injury, that it was a sprained ankle, and it was very close to being worse than that, to the sense where they were nervous about him being put on IR. I get that. But at some point, at the beginning of the season, he was healthy, and he spent the majority of his time during the season healthy. Healthy scratches, got in games, didn't really make a big impact. And that's something that scares me or worries me about this kind of player, is what is the expectation for LJ Collier moving forward? Because he is a first-round pick, and when you're a first-round pick, there's higher expectations. I certainly will always have high expectations for a first-round pick. I don't want to settle for a role player in that first round. But ultimately, I look at it now, and that's something that I would be happy with. I would love to see LJ Collier be a six-sack guy and be a guy that can be a great rotational player amongst this defensive line.
You'd like to see anybody be a six-sack guy, let's be honest.
No, for most first-round picks, I want them to be 10-sack guys.
I want them to be twitchy, Jake.
I want them to be guys that can really explode and make a difference. When you draft a guy in the first round, that's the expectation. For me, saying that I would love to have a six-sack guy, that to me is that's a rotational player. That's not a front line. That's my number one pass rusher.
But if he turned into Michael Bennett, you'd be okay with that.
Well, Michael Bennett was averaging about 6 or 7 sacks.
I understand that, but he was also a rotational player.
He was. But Michael Bennett, was he undrafted? I think there's just different pressure on him.
He was undrafted. There's different expectations. But also, when you look at Michael Bennett to start out in his career with the Seahawks the first couple seasons, yeah, I mean, he was a rotational player and then grew into that every down, you know, majority of the snaps type of starter for the Seahawks after the 2013 season. You know, it really grew in 14 and 15, and there you go. And, you know, with LJ, maybe that's what it is, but you know, for me, that would be a huge win if LJ was able to grow into that. Can he? That's a huge question. For me, I'm not sure because I didn't see any twitch. I didn't see any, you know, explosive play that really got me going and saying, okay, LJ Collier has this potential. He may not have it all put together yet, but this is something that I can go off.
Well, one thing that was interesting to me was both Pete Carroll and John Schneider. I know that you're always going to kind of hedge on in caution when you're talking about your first round pick because you probably still believe in your first round pick. He had one season, and B, you invested a lot of draft capital, so you want to make sure that outwardly you have a lot of confidence in him. Both, I thought it was interesting, did mention specifically that injury and how severe it was. But Pete Carroll with John Clayton earlier today at 11, I think he took it a little bit further in explaining to me how I interpreted it was Pete Carroll saying he not only missed out on a chance to get that work, but missed out on a chance to build trust with us, that we may not have had all the trust in him that we could have. Again, this is my interpretation of it. Nor did he have all the trust in himself that he might have because he missed that really, really pivotal developmental time.
God, they must put so much emphasis on that, on just training camp itself. Because like Jake said, once he came back, it wasn't like he missed the first 12 weeks of the season. Like, he was there long enough. I mean, I hear what Pete's saying, mm-hmm. where he may have missed a chance to develop trust. But he was still there long enough where I feel like they could have built that up.
Well, it could have been something where they thought Ziggy Ansah would do more, and then he didn't end up doing that. But by then, by the time they realized, okay, Ziggy Ansah isn't going to contribute the way we want him to, because Ziggy Ansah didn't start, he didn't play week one. I don't remember if he played week two. He was still out during the regular season. When he was finally activated, I'm sure it took a little while before they were like, oh, this isn't going to work out. By then, LJ Collier had been a healthy scratch in a few games. He didn't have as much work. So now you didn't give your rookie as much time as you might have had you known that you wouldn't have anything at that spot.
Now, Stace, you make a really good point because it shows up in multiple positions. It's not just LJ Collier. I look at that with Marquise Blair. I look at that with Ugo Amadi in particular. Those three players, if you're going along that narrative, Stacey, is they did not put in trust in the rookies that they drafted, which is very contrary to what they've always been, what Pete Carroll, John Schneider, and this group has always been. And so last year, to me, it came down to trying to avoid losses and trying to avoid mistakes rather than trusting your young people to continue to grow and continue to get better within your scheme and giving them those opportunities. But with LJ Collier, I think that could definitely be part of the equation. I think the injury could be part of the equation. But I just come back to it, guys. When you watch some of these elite edge rushers, even Michael Bennett, those guys would make flashy plays. It may not be consistent all the time, but you saw at a young age that they could make those type of plays that just made you go, okay, now it's a matter of, can we get this guy to do this on every single down? And that's really where it became. With LJ Collier, I have no idea where his starting point is.
But he really wasn't given that chance.
He was given opportunities on the field.
No, he really wasn't.
At that position, you don't need a defensive end. You don't need 200 reps on the field. Would it be ideal? Yes. But you don't need that many reps on the defensive line to show your capabilities, to show what you can do, you know, from a standpoint of your playmaking ability, your disruption. You know, you can flash. That's a position where you can show flashes as a rookie.
But Jake, you could also flash and still not be that productive of a player.
Correct,
Marquise,
but he didn't show anything.
And he hasn't even been, and they won't put him out on the field either.
But you saw it.
Yeah,
we can sit here, Tom,
and
look at it and say, that guy flashed. He made plays. Clowney. We can see the disruption. When you turn on the film, you watch it. So, no, I'm not sitting here asking that LJ Collier should have had all of these stats, but we didn't see flash in any situation
with him
last year.
But coming back to yesterday's conversation, Jake, in my tweet from yesterday, too. That's why I've lowered my expectations, right? I know that he's a number one pick, but a couple of years in, I kind of stopped caring about that. I just want him to be a productive player on the line. If he's good enough to draw attention away from whoever their big-time pass rushers are, I'm fine with that.
That means you're disrupting. That means you're showing flashes and capability that you actually are worth paying attention to. So I hope that he can turn into that guy too. But that's where I sit here and say, I'm not confident in what that looks like. Rasheem Green, I had more confidence in Rasheem Green going into year two than I have had in LJ Collier because I saw more from Rasheem Green in certain situations.
But Rasheem Green's been around here a couple of years now, and he's still not the player that he should be.
I think they're two different situations, though, and they kind of play, in my mind, Rasheem Green isn't like a five tech, right? They kind of play two different roles, so the expectations are slightly different. But I think the conversation between you guys is interesting to me because it's like a chicken versus egg thing. Is he not flashing because he wasn't given enough time on the field, or did the coaches not see what they needed to see to
Here's
give him
thing.
That time?
Here's the thing. Look, we talked about, let's just focus on this issue of flash real quick. He may not have shown that last year, but they did draft him number one overall. So obviously they've seen
for
some
first
flash.
First round, not run number
I'm
one.
I'm sorry, not number one.
I guess
first round.
Not.
Thank you. But obviously they saw some flash in him at the college level. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken him even close to that high. So they must have believed in him at some point.
They did, but it was also, you got to remember how the draft was going. They said multiple times that there was such a run on defensive ends that they were worried that they wouldn't even get anybody that was on their board.
He was a panic move?
It was
John Schneider said you can't do.
Right, but it was almost kind of that situation where, hey, we've got this pick. This is a need. This is a need we need. And we do like LJ Collier, but we would have rather have picked him in the second, maybe third round. We've got to do it in the first year because we don't think that he's going to be around anytime soon because of the way the draft is going. So I'm not sitting here trying to knock LJ Collier in his future. I want him to be a productive player, but he's got to do a heck of a lot in this offseason to then be tweeting out about, you know, the haters and, people doubted me and I'm going to come on top. That's great. Now, you've got to put in the work and show that you're a different dude in year two than you were in year one.
You know what's funny is I got a tweet yesterday. Somebody said this. They said, I'm with Jake.
I saw that.
I'm with Jake. I think he's going to surprise a lot of people next year. And then he's a couple other things. And I replied, I'm like, what do you mean you're with Jake? I'm the one who's defending him.
Well, you know, people just always assume that
I'm
going to
start commenting on your
tweets,
and I'm going to say, I'm with Jake. I love the band Fish. I love them.
Yeah, you know what you are? You're the new Brock.
Am I?
Even when, people wanted to agree with Brock, they would say that they like something that Mike said. It's like, yeah, I'm with Brock. Like, I really like Rush.
Hey, you know, I just got personalities that we connect with the people. You know what I mean?
This discussion is not over. Right now, I have three questions.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the we got to protect the kids nonsense.
Just thinking of more things to say that about. I'm with Jake. I'll find it.
I'm with Jake. I love guys who wear chains.
Yeah, I'm with Jake. I'm just a huge Giants fan.
If you were a coach or a veteran baseball player, what would you tell young players about this whole sign-stealing mess, other than don't steal signs?
Other than that, I think that there's more to winning the right way than there is winning at all costs. I think that's a perfect example of how winning at all costs can get you in trouble in a hurry, right? Like, at some point, you kind of cross the line and it's okay, and everybody else is doing it, so we're fine. And then at some point, they just went way over the line, and they convinced themselves that this is what we need to do to win. This is what's going to take us to the top, and if this is what we got to do, then it's worth every second of it. And that's the part I would be very, I would be teaching to my kids, and I would be teaching to everybody else that, look, winning at all costs isn't the right way to get it done.
It's not worth it, clearly.
It isn't worth it. It's winning the right way, and that's going to ultimately be what lasts, what's going to have a legacy, and what you can be proud of at the end of the day.
I think that's a good lesson. Unlike Jake, I'm not an actual coach, but I think what this reminds me of is as far as how you structure your program, thinking of what tools do I give my players to where if they're not okay with something, there's an avenue they could take. Because what you're constantly combating as a coach, especially the higher you get, you know, when you get to the pros, is that kind of clubhouse culture, which we've talked about a million times. And it's this idea that you can't turn on it. And that's really, really hard to do. And I completely empathize with that. And I don't know that I would have said anything either. So it's trying to establish either, you know, okay, I always want you to come to me and tell me if something's not okay. Or there should always be a tool that people have at their disposal where if something bad is happening and you feel like we aren't winning the right way, you can't just sit there and have nothing to say.
Next.
Number two.
Someone remind me why the Seahawks aren't going to use the franchise tag.
Because there's no one worth franchise tagging?
Yeah, you don't need to.
Here's the thing. With Clowney, they already made an agreement before he came in. That was part of the deal of him coming to Seattle, is that the Seahawks would allow him to go into free agency and they would not use the franchise tag on him. So that was a deal that they made. The only other person that would be worth franchise tagging is Jaron Reed. If you franchise tag Jaron Reed, that is way over the cost of what the market is for Jaron Reed. It wouldn't make any sense to try and franchise tag him. Although he's a guy you would love to have back, it's just not, that price is not worth it, and he's not going to get that money on the open market. I really do feel that as this goes along for Jaron Reed, he's going to quickly be humbled in the sense of he thought he was, you know, a $10, $12 million defensive tackle, and I think that the market's going to come back and tell him that he's an $8 million defensive tackle at best.
Kind of what Jake pointed out, too. I think the problem is the player that you would, Jaron Reed, is at a position where there's a big drop-off in the top salaries versus kind of where the average defensive tackle really is. And part of that has to do with guys that can be disruptive despite being an interior defensive lineman or that can play inside and outside. And then guys that are strictly just kind of like, I'm here to stop the run. Yeah. And that's kind of my job. So at the top of the defensive tackle pay scale, you have Aaron Donald, who's making like 20. He's making like defensive end money. Then you've got Fletcher Cox. And you have, you know, the top three guys are making as much as some edge rushers would make, whereas, you know, the average guy is making closer to 8 to 10 million, and or even, you know, a little bit over that or less. Like Sheldon Richardson's making 12 million or so. So the franchise tag averages the top five salaries at that position or 120% of the previous year's salary, whichever is greater. For Jaron Reed, because he's coming off a rookie deal, it would be the top five salaries. And like Jake said, there's just such a discrepancy between the top players at defensive tackle that would be more money than I think Seattle would be willing to spend on him. And everyone else is either someone that they could potentially let go or someone where they can afford to re-sign them to another deal. So you don't really need to.
Next.
Number three.
All right, I was thinking about this last night. How do the Astros get themselves out of this mess? Is it too early for them to start making fun of themselves publicly?
Oh, gosh.
Like, would self-deprecation be an effective strategy to lighten up the mood?
I feel like it always works. Self-deprecation is usually pretty funny, but I think you got to wait. Just a little
how
bit.
Much,
I think it's too
longer?
Soon. It's until at least this season. I don't know. Until something. You're still the villain
you
right
got,
now.
You got to wait quite some
well, and
time.
People don't think you're taking it seriously.
Correct.
You think this is a joke?
That's exactly what will happen.
Right now, people are in the belief that the Astros do not care. They are not sorry for what they did. And then just trying to add it with humor would just, I mean, man, that would be gasoline.
Like
on
if Jose Altuve took a picture of himself and posted on social media, like with a sign that said Houston asterisks on it.
Or he had like a fake buzzer on himself. Yeah.
Something.
The only thing that you could do would be like
way too soon.
If you won a trivia game, you could tweet out something. It has to be something mundane, and you can tweet out like, we came in second place, but at least I did it the right way.
Something like that.
But even that would be like,
it's too soon. But
the
here's
perception
the
is that they there soon. Isn't there isn't this feeling that they've actually apologized or felt sorry. So even though self-deprecation usually always works, you also have to kind of grovel a little bit before it's effective.
That may be true, but you can't wait too long either. People still have to care.
Oh, no, this joke will be good for a while.
You think so?
I looked up garbage can costumes, like every single costume website I go to. I wasn't trying to buy them. I was trying to see if they even had the costume. I went, and they're like all sold out. They're going to be all over ballparks.
Be a good couple's costume. You have one of you dress up as
an
Astros
player. And one can be a
bat. The other can be a trash can.
Yeah.
And you can walk around just hitting the person.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I think that I think there's something to that. Maybe by May.
I'm interested to see, because there's going to be some videos out there and pictures, and I'm interested to see which ballpark or who has the best, you know,
parody of
the situation during a game.
Well, here's the thing: if Altuve or Bregman or one of those guys went out there at this point and did try to make fun of themselves, they were self-effacing, you know, there'd be a huge group of people that would not find it funny in the least.
Do you think
they would point at it and be like, say what you said, basically, like, these guys have not apologized yet. Yeah. I don't find this the least bit funny.
Well, and I'm wondering, because then you all have to be on the same page, because you know that the minute they have walk-up songs and one of the players choose a song that has some kind of tone of, like, I don't care or something like that, that's going to be a story. It's just going to be a constant story throughout the season. Whichever angle people are going to take, it will be constant.
I think you got to make fun of yourself at some point.
I know. You just got to wait. Just wait on it a little bit. Or apologize first and then do it. That's
sincere apology. That might be good.
Mike Salk is very, very excited about his latest podcast guest. He's going to tell us about that next. Some great stories coming up on 710 ESPN Seattle. And we're glad to have Mike Salk in after a day off yesterday. Sorry about that, Mike.
That was okay. You guys obviously chose Pete over me. I could see that. He was making really wacky jokes about DK Metcalf and taking his shirt off.
I thought that
Pete was on fire.
Isn't there a point where that joke kind of gets a little old?
No.
Is there?
Well, he found a new
Or has there been one? Yeah, I think that point may have come and gone, Tom. I don't know. That's just me.
You know, a question that we're asking today, just kind of briefly, because we don't really have much other Mariner discussion other than the young players, right?
Right.
The guys that we're most interested in aren't even really going to be playing in April, say. If you were Scott Servais and you're looking at your young players, what would your biggest takeaway from this whole Astros mess be? And what would you say to the young players? What would you want them to take from that?
Yeah, I mean, baseball has, and we've talked about this here, and we talked about it on the Brock and Salk podcast yesterday. By the way, just a quick plug for the Brock and Salk podcast yesterday. It's my favorite one so far. Eric O'Flaherty, former Mariners, Braves pitcher, A's pitcher, came in and talked to us for almost an hour and just told stories, and he was hysterical. So, brockandsalkpodcast.com. One of the things he talked about was kind of, you know, that challenge that baseball has between how important the clubhouse is and the sanctity of not telling. I mean, he thinks Mike Fiers is a snitch. Back in his view, Mike Fiers broke the rules of a clubhouse and is a snitch.
Eric said this?
Yes. He also thinks that what the Astros did is inconscionable and they should be punished. And so how do you put those two things together, right? On one hand, you think what they did was bad. On the other hand, you can't believe that a guy actually broke the sanctity of the clubhouse. He was like, yeah, I don't think I'd break that sanctity for anything. You know, maybe murder. And I was like, even murder? He's like,
maybe.
Maybe not. I mean, like, you kind of get to that point where it's like, nope, the clubhouse is family. And it's almost like being friends or having your family be like the Soprano crime family, where you're like, hey, that's my family business. What are you going to do? Sometimes it involves murder. We don't tell people about it because it's family. I don't approve of it, but I don't tell people about it either. So I think you've got to get them to start to respect the game of baseball and the game overall, and not just the sanctity of the clubhouse. And you just kind of want them playing the game the right way. I mean, that has to be the message, that we play the game the right way.
I would also warn the young players, like, that could be you if you step out of line. Like, look at what some of the superstars of this game are going through right now.
Yeah,
Altuve,
no one's above it.
And Bregman and all these guys. No matter how good of a great of a player you are, you cheat or you wander outside, you color outside the lines.
Yeah.
That could be you.
I think the more positive message, and I would assume this is a big part of where Scott will go, and we heard some of this from O'Flaherty yesterday as well, is, look, having a group of guys come up together can be a big deal. He sort of poo-pooed a lot of the bonding that goes on and some of the forced bonding that goes on at spring training. And
forced bondage?
Yeah, forced bonding. No, where the managers are trying to get, or coaches trying to get everybody on the same page. But the way that really occurs is over the years, right? If Kelnick and Rodriguez and Logan Gilbert and some of the rest of these guys are all playing together and traveling on the buses in the minor leagues together, that's where these best friends perform, right? I mean, he was talking about some of the guys that he came up with in the Mariner system, Matuidi Sissoko and Mike Wilson and a couple other names like that that you may remember. And he's saying, look, we all ended up going our separate ways, but those are still my best friends in the world. Those are the guys that, you know, we went through riding the bus to God knows where together in single and double A. I think some of that, you're seeing some of that now and over the last year or so with Kelnick and Rodriguez and some of these other guys where they've tried to keep them together as much as possible and give them those opportunities to form a dynamic, which hopefully will help them when they get up here. We saw it with Justin Dunn and Kyle Lewis and a few of those guys who all came up together at the end of last year, and hopefully it'll pay dividends as soon as this year, but really next.
It's interesting, you know, we're talking about all these guys, these young players that aren't even up in the big leagues yet, and it gets to a point where I wonder when is good enough? Because you look at guys like, I point to Tatis in San Diego Padres. He's amazing, right? And he's a young player. People want to point to, you know, Juan Soto and how young he is. If those guys, if Scott Servais is looking at Kelnick, and again, I'm approaching this from a football side and not a baseball side, so I understand that there's a process here. If they're looking at them going, man, those guys are so good.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are the future. What's a couple months? What's a couple months different for Kelnick bringing them up right away?
There's probably two or there's a bunch of reasons in why baseball can end up being different from football here. One, you know, is just the service time. Once you start the clock on those guys, you've started the clock, and that's that much closer to having to pay them and letting them run out their rookie contract. So, you know, in football, you're being paid from the moment you get drafted. In baseball, once they start the clock on you, you know, that changes things, number of option years, et cetera. The second, I think, and there are just some cautionary tales of guys that get brought up too early, and maybe you think they're ready, but they come up and they don't end up succeeding. And in fact, if the game, you know, the confidence level decreases because they get blown away at the major league level, and they're never able to fully recover. I recommend Mike DiGiovanna, who writes in L.A., has a really good piece this week on Brandon Wood. You may remember that name.
He was
Angel
number one prospect.
Yeah, forever. He was the number one prospect in baseball for a few years, and he's a complete and total bust. And he talks about just the pressure that he was never able to overcome it. And so you don't want that to happen. I think you could make an argument that Dustin Ackley and a few of those guys were brought up too early here. Mike Zunino, maybe, were brought up too early and didn't actually have enough time to learn the game. This game is complicated. And the adjustments that it takes and the mind, the maturity, it's hard to do in your early 20s. You've got to be perfect to do it. You've got to be special. And Soto seems to be that guy. The Braves also had a pretty good team that they could roll him out with.
Right.
So he's got some cover.
My question or my curiosity is, what is a couple months? Because the conversation that we've heard so far is that there's a potential that they could bring Kelnick up in May and June.
Yep.
So what's the difference for a couple months? I get
two
everything
things.
That you
well,
just
one,
said.
Well, one, it might be Super 2. It might be a Super 2, right? You want to make sure you get your full 6 years of them and you don't get stuck with only five.
Okay.
So that's one. The second is, you know, there's attitude. There's letting a guy think too much of himself versus not enough. I mean, baseball is complicated, even though it's you know, these things sound kind of ridiculous at times where you're like, just throw the guy out there and see what happens. It's easy to say as a fan. When you actually think about the psychology involved in this game, which is unlike any other, the space in between too confident and too arrogant and not confident enough and the bravado that's in there is, you know, that's how great managers are made. That's how great player development guys are made, great GMs. And so much of it is the development of these young guys. The Mariners, you know, get crushed for not having drafted well over the last decade or so. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's true. But it's also possible that they did draft pretty well, but they developed horribly, and they either rushed guys or didn't teach them the right way along the path, and that's why they haven't been successful with so many of these top picks.
I can't remember another offseason where I've spent as much time talking solely about prospects that might not even be with the club when they break camp, much less just this year. And it's fine. I find it really interesting. It's my first time kind of diving that deep into it. But of the guys that are actually going to break camp with the Mariners,
sure,
who do you think has the most pressure to show that Jerry DePoto's plan is on track?
Well, I think the person who may feel the most pressure, the two guys that'll feel it, would be J.P. Crawford and
Evan White.
I don't think so.
That was what I was thinking.
I would go with Crawford and Sheffield would be my two. I think you know, Justice Sheffield is the number one return back from Paxton, who was a big prospect, succeeded here, had the know. I mean, Paxton's a pretty good player, injuries aside. And Sheffield was a top prospect with the Yankees. He's a big name. He didn't deliver last year, but he's still a really young kid. They've sent him back down for some of that seasoning and development, and I think he has an opportunity to show that what Jerry did with that deal worked and that they didn't just give Paxton away before they needed to. The other guy is Crawford, and more just because he's had a few years of seasoning. He's not just a young kid anymore. He's now starting to enter that age where you're looking for some results out of J.P. Crawford. So I liked a lot of what I saw from him last year. I thought he was very promising, but he was, you know, this is a guy, super huge prospect with the Phillies, came up disappointed, got hurt, went back down, never really fully realized it, but they didn't give him a huge rope and they dealt him here. And now you get a chance to see whether or not this potential, you know, once top prospect in the game can actually deliver on what he was supposed to be. So those would be the two guys I would point out the most. I mean, I think Evan White's got some leeway. I know that they're paying him some money before he's done anything, so you want to see whether or not it works. That's sort of a DePoto thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not going to judge Evan White based on the very beginning. He's a long-term project for me.
Thanks, Mike.
See you guys.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by Car Toys. Up next, we've got a side of Russell Wilson you've never seen before. That's next on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Now, yesterday, as many of you know or may not know, the CBA was definitely in the news. Player reps and the owners met for about 4 hours yesterday. And at the end of the day here, we have NFL players, many of them who are not happy with the deal the owners are trying to give them. Russell Wilson tweeted this out. He said, the NBA and the MLB are doing it right. Players come first. All NFL players deserve the same. We should not rush the next 10 years for today's satisfaction. I vote no, all in caps. Now, Russell Wilson, early in his career, and really for most of it, has been, publicly anyway, kind of a go-with-the-flow guy, right? Just sort of toeing the company line, that sort of thing. This is a little bit different for him. Like, if Russell Wilson is upset with what the owners are trying to pitch here and what the player reps are agreeing to, you know that there's a big problem.
Yeah, there is, from the standpoint of, I think, from the top and the way that they look at it in terms of the players, it is a situation where it becomes about revenue. It becomes about making sure, and what I think Russell's sentiment was, is making sure that the players are taken care of. And you look at the NBA, you look at Major League Baseball, and they have gone to the point where they make sure that they are taking care of their players. And the NFL being a situation where it is the most physically demanding out of those three sports, it's hard to imagine that, you know, taking care of the players in a sense wouldn't be a priority to this league. From the standpoint, I don't know if they're ever going to get to the point where they'll get guaranteed contracts. I just can't imagine that would end up happening, because this, as brutal as it is, this league is just too... The NFL is too injury prone. I mean, NFL owners and teams would be strapping themselves and watering down the product if you put yourself in that position, because you're going to have a guy who gets injured and is never able to live up to the contract that he, you know, signed up for. Now, with that being said, what I think the players should be after is they should be after a 50-50 split revenue share. They should be after that in order to boost the salary cap. They should be after that to boost their medical benefits. They should be there to try and boost their long-term benefits of what they get after, you know, life after football. That's what I would be concerned about if I'm the players moving forward with the CBA, and that's what I would be trying to get done. If I've got 10 years, and that's the uniqueness of the CBA, is you sign this and it's 10 years down the line from the next time you have a chance to renegotiate. At some point, you got to take a stand when you really feel adamant about this. And this is the first time I really feel like the players, in some sort of solidarity, have felt this way across the board and have really expressed this, at least from the top level. Obviously, yeah. There is the bottom half of the NFL players that I look at a lot of these benefits, and there's, you know, some positive things that they've been able to alter in terms of the original proposal that the owners have given. But it's really going about it in that sense, and that's the only way things are ever going to get to the level that they can feel good about moving forward. But I don't know if they have the strength or the power or the solidarity across the board to be able to get it done.
That said, it is really interesting just to see that side of Russell Wilson. When I saw that this morning, I was kind of taken aback by it. Not because it's incredibly controversial. It's just an opinion about, you know, an employee of a company saying this new labor agreement doesn't sit well with me. There's nothing like inflammatory about that. But
and there's been many other players, by the way,
absolutely,
today who have come out and said the same thing.
Yeah, but if you would have told me, you know, three seasons ago, hey, Russell Wilson, or five, Russell Wilson just tweeted this, I'd be like, no, he didn't.
Yeah,
that's a spoof account. But I do. I think it's interesting. I think it's a tough problem because the NFL owners have so much power, and it doesn't sound like the players are at all on the same page. Even the vote of the board of reps that sent it to go to all the players, it was like 17-14, and then one person opted out. So that's almost like a 50-50 maybe right. Didn't go through kind of thing. There are still players, and I have to think, if that doesn't represent the majority of players, that there's certainly going to be a good portion of players who are still not happy with this and still feel like we didn't get enough back in exchange for the 17-game season, which is incredibly costly to our bodies. And we know that you want it. We know it's not because you think fans want the experience. We know that you just want more money. So share some of that with us. And it sounds like maybe one of the only things they got was that, this is according to Dan Graziano, that $250,000 cap on the 17th game, which is the weirdest thing, that is now taken away. It remains to be seen what other kind of concessions were made, but it sounds like the owners didn't make a ton. And if you're a player, that's frustrating because you feel like you still kind of lost.
Are they getting paid for that 17th game or not?
Yes, they are. So that cap that she just said, it was $250,000 for that week 17 game across the board. Didn't matter what player you were.
No matter what player you are, that's how much you can get paid for that one game.
Game, which didn't make any sense from the standpoint of, if I am one of the top players, why am I all of a sudden I'm playing an extra week and I'm not getting the same paycheck that I got in week 16?
And I know there are
that doesn't really make
sense.
They took that away.
Yeah, and I know that there were people being like, why are you complaining about that? Well, none of us are paying the players. Like, if this isn't like taxpayer money that's going to their salaries, like, it's not coming out of your pocket. And secondly, if someone told me, okay, you're actually going to work 6 days a week, but on the sixth day you come in, we're only going to pay you half of what your salary would normally
be. It's ludicrous.
I'd be like, what?
Or not even half of that.
You're going to work more.
Why?
And we're going to pay you less.
Yeah.
Yes.
It makes no sense.
No. So the other thing is, if in terms of the arguments or in terms of the negotiation, that's what the players should be after. I saw a tweet that Aaron Rodgers was a part of these meetings, and he was extremely vocal about wanting even more time off from the offseason. I'm sorry, Aaron, sit down and let's not talk about the offseason that you guys have, because it's pretty dang good. I've been through it myself. It's not that bad. So, you know, I get that you want more free time and this and that, but it's really not that bad. So
more free time from what? OTAs?
From OTAs and mini camp and training camp and, you know, the practices, they want more concessions to save their body. I actually think it's counterintuitive. I think that actually when you go through practice that you do need some live contact, that you do need that in order to build your body up and to get yourself ready to go. I think a lot of times you see more injuries based off of the fact that you have players that haven't gone full speed, haven't gone full contact as much as they've had but in the past. And, you know, it's harder for them to gear up to that week one. I'm not saying it needs to be like the olden days. Not so what I'm saying, but I'm just saying Aaron Rodgers doesn't need to be fighting for that. They have a pretty good situation now. The focus should be on the revenue split and how that's being allocated to the players in salary cap, medical, and long-term benefits. That's what the players should be ultimately after. And seeing guys like Russell Wilson, who never has said anything, has become more vocal on the issue. And now you're seeing more and more players. Quandre Diggs has been extremely vocal. Tyler Lockett. Like these are guys that don't normally say stuff like this in terms of these kind of issues. They're more guys that just, you know, step up and play. And so if they're coming out and saying something about it, it's interesting to see what this whole agreement will end up being. But, you know, a guy like in my position and the way I sympathize with the bottom half players is, look, this isn't a situation where I have the luxury to sit out, you know, for a year. I don't think it would ever come to that point. I saw a tweet by Boy Howdy, which I thought was really well, is, guys in my position shouldn't panic. Owners more than anything, their fear is missing games. They don't want to miss games. So they're probably going to cave in at some point if you're missing one, two, you know, maybe even three games of the season. You're going to recoup that all, you know, after that anyway. So I think that there is a little bit of more benefit to hold solidarity in this situation if you're the players. But I certainly can empathize and understand where the bottom half guys are coming from, and that's what makes up the majority of this league.
And that's what's tough about it. I think one last thing is just that I think that why some players, from my point of view, why some players might also be frustrated is that 17th game is kind of like your trump card. Like, that's your card where you're like, this is the biggest thing that we'd be willing to give up, and I feel like we didn't get enough back for it, and now we're just getting kind of run over by the owners.
What's one thing that Russell wants from Pete Carroll? Forget about the owners. What's one thing that Russell Wilson wants from Pete Carroll? We'll talk about that next on 710 ESPN Seattle.